This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Ed White has chronicled gay culture for over two decades in his fiction and nonfiction. He came out when he was 12, but was so guilt-ridden he spent 7 years going to psychiatrists hoping to be cured. He was at the Stonewall Bar the night of the 1969 Stonewall Uprising, which marks the beginning of the gay rights movement. That night also marked a turning point in his life. His essays are collected in the book The Burning Library. They begin in 1969 and end deep into the AIDS era. White is HIV positive. In 1993, White won a National Book Award for his biography of the French writer Jean Genet. Edward White now lives in Paris. Terry Gross spoke with him last November and asked him to read an excerpt from his newest collection of short stories called Skinned Alive. This is from a story called Watermarked, about first love.
Our love worked well because Randall was the one man in 1,000 who welcomed devotion and who, like a medieval princess, believed in it only after it had been proved by many deeds and long trials. Most men like chasing after rather than being the quarry and flee someone too obviously in love. Being adored suffocates and gives them too little imaginative scope. Only someone unobtainable leaves enough room for dreams, inspires longing, promotes scheming, and implies arrival, whereas a quick and total conquest is the last act that abrogates all need for the preceding drama. But Randall had had enough strife at home and wanted to be cherished. I so enjoyed serving him and supporting him and listening to him that I forgot my own existence. Certainly my own uninteresting face. If I would glance at my own reflection after a long evening spent with him, I'd be offended by the reminder that such sustained communion hadn't improved my looks. I learned what a burden beauty can be. Drunk men at parties would take an instant dislike to Randall. Eventually I figured out their reasoning. I want him. He thinks he's too good for me. The bastard. He didn't want to be liked merely for his looks, but he needed to maintain them just in case.
As you've gotten older, how has your idea of the ideal companion changed?
Well, I think that I now prize real intimacy more than I did before. Perhaps I didn't even know what it was. I mean, I lost my lover to AIDS this last March, and his name was Hubert. He was French. I was with him for 5 years. And I think that in my own case, I was always afraid of intimacy with people. But when you live with someone, I mean, the last 4 of the 5 years that we were together, we knew that he had AIDS and didn't have long to live. And when you know, when you're living with somebody that you know is not going to live very long, you give up all your fears about guarding your independence, and you just give yourself completely to somebody, just as I feel that he gave himself to me. I mean, he had been married when I met him, and he gave up his wife, his language, his country, his job, to come with me when I was coming to Providence to teach at Brown University in 1990. And so I felt like he had made a total gift of himself to me, and that's what I wanted to be able to give to him. But I think before that, I had never really understood that kind of gift. I mean, I hear people today talk about codependency as though it's a bad thing, but I think, in fact, that's what love is. Love is codependency. It's perfectly okay to be codependent.
Throughout your career as a writer, you've written about relationships and about being gay. And there's something that you wrote in a 1977 essay called The Joys of Gay Life about relationships that I'd like you to read for us.
Sure, with pleasure. One of the things we are forced to reexamine is relationships. Unlike straight people, we do not have church weddings. We are not often enrolled in the PTA. We are not clear on who is the breadwinner and who is the homemaker. We don't have relatives clucking over us, urging us to be faithful and fertile and upstanding. Our relationships have little social or legal reality. As a result, we must invent love all over again.
I'm wondering the different ways you feel you've invented love. You know, if you feel like you've invented it and reinvented it over the years as things have changed.
Well, yes, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that probably originally, as this story Watermarked reveals, one of my images probably for love was something like the gentleman who's in love with a dancer at the ballet or something like that. I mean, I was the guy who wasn't so great looking but who was very ardent, and the other person, the person I was in love with, tended to be somebody extraordinarily beautiful. And I've written quite a bit about physical beauty. And I know that some of my gay critics have accused me of looksism, which is supposed to be a very bad thing. But I think, of course, most artists are probably sensitive to beauty in all of its forms. But it, for me, I think it was part of my own inferiority complex that I, not just because I felt I was quite average looking, but also because I felt inferior as a gay man. And I needed to have this terribly flashy beauty on my arm to reassure myself that I was okay. And as a consequence, I learned a lot about what it must be like to be beautiful and to have all the problems and advantages of being extraordinarily beautiful. But I think over the years, that notion changed. I mean, maybe because I became more sure of myself, but I'm not at all indifferent to physical beauty, but it's not very high on my priority list anymore. I think what I like most now is tenderness, a reciprocal love, shared interests, and I think tenderness is really the word.
If this isn't too personal, has your idea of monogamy changed over the years, of the relative importance or unimportance of it?
I've never believed that people should try to be monogamous. I think there's something slightly dispiriting and kind of lower middle class about the idea of wanting to, I mean, sort of suburban about wanting to be faithful. I mean, with Hubert, my last lover, I was faithful because it's what I wanted to be. It didn't occur to me to be any way else. I think when you feel drawn to the other person to such an extent, and you have such a trust with the other person that monogamy is inevitable, well, then I think it's perfectly okay. But as an ideal, I don't hold it up.
Writer Ed White is my guest. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ed White is my guest. I want to read an excerpt from an essay you wrote in 1983 that was originally published in Vanity Fair called Sexual Culture. And you were writing, "No homosexual can take his homosexuality for granted. He must sound it, palpate it. For that reason, all homosexuals are, quote, gay philosophers, and that they must invent themselves." And then you wrote, "On the other hand, no straight man stands in rapt contemplation of his straightness unless he's an ass." And I guess, you know, like so much of your life has been given over to writing about being gay, both in your essays, in your autobiographies, in your fiction.
You know, I have the strange feeling that writing itself is somehow linked to homosexuality. I haven't worked this out, so I won't be able to make any sense of it. But I think it's really very odd if you think of it that, now, Time magazine tells us this week that only 1.5% of people are gay. So if that's true, think how very, very few homosexuals there actually are. And yet, if you look at the famous writers of this century, I mean, a huge high proportion of them are gay. And it seems to me that there is something that about writing itself, which is a way of at once participating in society, but also looking at it from an enormous distance, of at once imitating the conventions of society while having a very jaundiced eye toward them. It seems to me that spirit which animates the work of homosexual writers like Proust, for instance, or Gide, or Jean Genet, it seems to me that there is something fundamental. I mean, in other words, something about being gay means that you pass or can pass as an ordinary member of society, and yet you always feel different. You always feel that you're of this other race. So it's a bit, I suppose, like a black person who looks white or a Jew who doesn't look Jewish, who is passing as a Gentile or as a white person or in the case of a homosexual, as a heterosexual. In other words, you're a kind of double agent and you're living a different kind of life from the one you feel inside. And so I think when I keep talking in these essays about the need of gay people to invent themselves, it's also, I think, that they have a need for seeing through the conventions of ordinary society.
So you think part of the reason why you became a writer was the sense of being the double agent?
Definitely. I think the very when I first began writing, it was like a kind of a desperate attempt to fight off the waves of self-hatred and guilt that I think were really threatening my sanity. I mean, when I was 14 or 15 years old, a psychiatrist told my mother that I should be put in a mental hospital and they should just throw the key away, that I was unsalvageable. And I certainly was, I think, right on the edge of a mental collapse. And the one thing that saved me was writing. And I went to a boarding school, and I would do all my homework in the afternoon so that at night during study hall, all I would have to do for those 2 hours was work on my novel. So I had already finished a novel by the time I was 15, another one by the time I was 17. And I didn't write in a kind of arty way. I was writing out of a real desperate need to make sense of the world, to fight off this madness.
Let me just backtrack for a second here. I think I know what you mean, but why would a straight person who stands in rapt contemplation of his heterosexuality be an ass?
Well, it'd be like a white person sort of looking at his own body and saying, oh, aren't I beautiful? I'm all white. I mean, you would just say, what a nitwit, you know. Whereas a black person who says black is beautiful, you can understand that, because since the dominant society did, at least until 20 or 30 years ago, find the state of being black inferior, and little black girls back in those days used to buy white dolls. To say black is beautiful was a revolutionary statement. To say white is beautiful is idiotic.
So it's about contemplating your difference.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, I think if you're coming from a persecuted minority, you need to redefine yourself, not in the terms of the dominant society, but in your own terms, in new terms that will empower you or enfranchise you. Whereas if you are already a member of the dominant society, to simply glory in being dominant is fatuous.
In one of your essays, you write that although at some point in your career, you started writing for what you perceived as a sophisticated gay reader. Earlier on, as a writer, you saw your audience as an older European heterosexual woman.
Yes.
Well, who was this idealized reader, and why?
Well, I think it was Mrs. Nabokov, and because, and she actually would read my writing. And when I finally met her years later, after her husband had died, I went to the Montreux Palace Hotel in Switzerland and met her. And she was already quite deaf, and she did that thing that deaf people oftentimes do of just doing all the talking, because that way they don't have to hear what you have to say. But I didn't mind, because she also did the thing that every writer dreams of another person doing. She recited pages of my first novel, Forgetting Elena, by heart, because she, in fact, had a photographic memory. And she could just summon up whole pages of one's prose and recite them. And to have the woman to whom Nabokov dedicated every one of his novels and the muse of the greatest writer of the century recite to you whole pages of your own work was, of course, the most delicious thrill imaginable. So, but long before that, before I ever knew her, but when I knew that, in fact, she was reading my writing because she would write me notes about it, I did have her as a kind of ideal reader, and not just because I admired her husband and her and them as a couple, but also because it seemed to me like a filter to make sure that, I mean, one of the things that I sometimes don't like about contemporary gay writing is that I feel that it makes a lot of inside references that make it accessible only to other gay people. And one of the things I wanted to try to do was to write about gay experience from the inside and in a fairly sophisticated way without any hint of apology, and yet in a way that would be totally accessible to people who weren't gay. And I don't know. I mean, once a heterosexual man in England said to me that he never had thought he'd had a single homosexual thought in his whole life, but that he had found himself getting very excited once reading one of my sex scenes between two men. And that thrilled me, not because I had managed to excite this particular man, but who wasn't one of my dream people, but just the idea that I had been able to communicate what that kind of desire would be like to somebody who wasn't cut out for it at all.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, as I always do.
Terry Gross speaking with Ed White. Ed White's latest collection of short stories is called Skinned Alive. This is Fresh Air.